G'day folks, and welcome to Stick With It, APIT's podcast for its pilots. Thanks for tuning in to another chat. This topic has been on my agenda since we started the podcast series, with the aim to try and demystify some complex areas associated with APIT. So today we will try and scratch the surface of providing you with a better understanding of the industrial relations framework that your EAs are negotiated in, some additional insights into the actual process of negotiation, and what part you can play in that process. Joining me today is a member of our APIT in-house legal team, Philip Vanderhever, First Officer Mark Knight, Captain Chris Hewitt, and Captain Jason Bevan, who have all been involved in a number of negotiations on behalf of APIT. Now to Philip. As we record this chat, the recent jobs summit in Canberra has recently occurred, and at this point we don't yet know the outcome of any proposed changes. However, can you gents provide our members with a bit of background to the existing industrial landscape and some of the historical context of how this landscape was created?
Yeah, thanks, Mark. It's a privilege to be here, so thank you for that, for the opportunity. Look, if we have to talk about the historical context of workplace relations in Australia, we'll probably be here until next year. And perhaps that's a day for another podcast for those who are interested in history. But I think it's perhaps more relevant just to refer to the fact that in 1993, there was fundamental reforms to the industrial relations system where the commission were given some powers in resolving disputes. But also more importantly, enterprise bargaining was said to happen between employers and employees at a enterprise level. In other words, there was not a centralized bargaining system which governed the employment relations of employees in Australia. I think before we go continue, when we talk about this topic, it's perhaps necessary to just inform members about some of the words that they use sometimes and not knowing that they have different meanings. So there's three types of terms that we use. The first is employees' contract of employment. A second one is award, when we talk about awards and what that means. And the third one is an enterprise agreement or an agreement such as the Qantas long haul and the Jetstar and the short haul agreements. First of all, a contract of employment is what is the term that is used to refer to the common law contract between an employer and an employee when you start out. It is the underlying agreement that sets, that makes the employee, the person, an employee of the employer. Secondly, when we talk about an agreement, that can either be a workplace agreement or what we are going to talk here about, the enterprise agreement. Those agreements sets out the terms and conditions that governs the employment contract between the parties. Mm-hmm. In other words, that sets out pay, terms and conditions and so forth. And then finally, we talk about awards. Awards are instruments that are created by the Fair Work Commission that sets out the minimum standards of employment for employees in certain industries. Now, since 1993, so parties were able to collectively negotiate with one another. Employer was able to collectively bargain with an employee or employee group about their terms and conditions. And what was quite useful back then is that the then Australian Industrial Relations Commission had the power to resolve disputes at that enterprise level. Fast forward to mid-2000s, the Howard government progressively removed the power of the commission to resolve disputes between the employee and the employer. To the extent where the commission could only resolve those disputes by agreement between the parties. Another thing that the Howard government did, which we all know, I'm not going to go into too much detail about that, is set up what we call AWAs, Australian Workplace Agreements, which allowed for individual contracts to be created in workplaces where there were already enterprise agreements in place. Right. Now, obviously, that infuriated the union movement, which ultimately led to the demise of the Howard government in 2007 when the Rudd government was elected. Following that election, the Labor Party set about to create what we know today as the Fair Work Act, which created a whole new legislative framework in which bargaining happened. And one of the things that the Fair Work Act did not do was put back the commission's power to resolve disputes in a bargaining sense. What it did was it implemented what we call the good faith provisions in the agreement. That is broadly the framework in which we are dealing at the moment.
So is it fair to say that the playing field is weighted towards the employees or the employer at the moment?
I think it's fair to say that unions and workers are generally disappointed since 2009 in the way that the Commission has interpreted the provisions of the Act when it comes to bargaining more in favour of the employer group. There's no doubt about that. One big aspect that occurred in the last 11 years was the 2015 decision in Orizon, which basically said that it was a legitimate bargaining strategy to make an application to the Fair Work Commission to terminate an enterprise agreement as part of a bargaining strategy with the aim of gaining productivity. These type of things have certainly made it very difficult for employees to, what they believe, reach fair and reasonable agreements with employers,
okay.
No doubt.
Is that likely to change in the near future? I mean, given obviously the Labor federal government is back in, are they going to be looking to change in existing industrial legislation to try and to maybe change that playing field a little bit?
Yes, there is some changes that we are expecting. As most people, members would probably know, last week was the Job Summit. And we have done a lot of lobbying with the ACTU, also in Canberra, talking to politicians about what some of those changes might be. If we read between the lines and hear among the grapevine what is being proposed, there's certainly a push from within Labor and the Labor Party itself to make it more difficult for employers to terminate the enterprise agreement during a bargaining period. We haven't seen the legislation. We don't know exactly what it's going to say, but it appears to be that it will be very favourable to us and will not be not that easy to do. And then the final thing that might be beneficial to us is, and which just last week the Labor Party has said that they want to push forward, is multi-enterprise agreements, which means it is an enterprise agreement, a collective agreement, but with more than one employer. Now, it's not clear how that's going to work, whether that's going to be industry-based, whether it's going to be geographically based, what supply chain-based, I don't know, we don't know. We do know that Qantas strongly came out after the summit last week speaking against multi-employer agreements because they are obviously concerned about their business model and how that would affect them. So while we are hopeful that there might be some changes that could be beneficial to us, we have to wait and see until the final legislation is drafted to know whether or not it will materialise in something of worth for us. Yeah.
Okay. Now, I guess now we've got a bit of an idea of the playing field. Now we'll talk to Jason, Chris and Mark a bit more because they're the guys that have done plenty of negotiations, so are well-versed in battling on that playing field. So I guess when you guys settle up for negotiation under this legislation that's just been outlined, can you explain to us some of the philosophies that you take into the room to try and achieve a deal?
In the last couple of negotiations, you've probably heard the team talk about the term interest-based negotiations. So when you're negotiating, there's various models or strategies that you can use to approach a negotiation. But in a situation that we have, which is where we've got an ongoing relationship, we're continuously working with Qantas, where one negotiation leads and has consequences that lead on to the next negotiation, we've found that the best method to use is interest-based negotiation. So I'll use an example, and some of the members may have heard this example before. With positional bargaining, which is your traditional log of claims, you walk in, you've got a list of, basically what you've got is a list of solutions to the problems that you've identified. So you come in with the solutions, and it generally works in a way that if I win something, if I get something, the other party necessarily loses.
Yeah.
So interest-based negotiations, we're trying to get away from that zero-sum game and trying to come up with win-win situations. Now, it's not always possible. So the example that people may have heard, two children fighting over a lemon. So your traditional type of position-based bargaining might be, well, maybe one child can have the lemon and the other child gets nothing. Or the let's meet in the middle, let's split the difference. We'll cut the lemon in half and one child can have one half and the other child can have the other half. But if you were to dig down and find out what it is that the two children were actually wanting, you might discover, for instance, that one child wanted to bake a cake. They wanted the lemon zest. And the other child wanted to make some lemonade and they just wanted the juice. Yep. So the one lemon could actually meet the interests of both the parties. So neither party had to walk away losing. There was a win-win outcome. And yep. Not necessarily always the case, but if you don't go down the path of trying to discover that, then you don't know if there are win-win outcomes. So that's the sort of strategy that we've been using. It takes a lot of work.
It strikes me as this. You need good communication from both sides because you need to be able to work out what each other want.
Exactly. And then we'll talk about that, I guess, a little later about the skills required to negotiate effectively and to have a good team. But yes, so it's about discovering what the needs of both parties are. So not just what your needs are, but what the needs of the other party are. And I think that the other people here will agree that walking into a negotiation, about 80% of the work is preparation, 20% of the work at the table.
Did you guys want to add anything to that?
Look, Jason will speak in a moment about what the actual process is we go through as we approach bargaining. But a lot of the comments that I often hear about interest-based bargaining versus positional and traditional log of claim styles of negotiation is that interest-based bargaining is probably a little bit more touchy-feely and a little bit more softly approach. That's simply not the case. We have just as many disagreements when we do interest-based bargaining. The problem is that with positional bargaining, if we put a claim across the table, really, it's only a yes-no answer that we can get from the other side. Whereas if we say we have a particular problem, we don't really mind how we solve this problem. We might have an idea about it and we can explore those, but we'd like to hear what you have to say about some of the solutions we might propose and let's work on a solution together. My way of dumbing it down even further than what Chris is saying is we come to the table with problems as opposed to pre-worked solutions, which is exactly what Chris just said. And the way we come up with those solutions is we work on it together. Because it's probably a bit of an old school way of thinking, you know, the win-lose thing. There are absolutely circumstances, and we've witnessed them with these over the years, where win-win solutions are absolutely possible, but they take a lot of work, and therein lies the really hard work and the art of negotiation.
Does it also require, dare I say, the other side to be receptive to that same model of bargaining?
That's a very good question. The negotiations that I have been involved in, and I think this would, to a large extent, bar one, maybe long-haul negotiation, Qantas has approached it in a very positional way. So, yes, it does require both parties to do it. And, again, that is the challenge, is to try and drag the other side to your way of thinking when it comes to the process and say, this is not how we want to negotiate. We actually want to come in here, explore all options on the table. We should create a comfortable environment in which we're allowed to do that and explore all possible solutions. It guarantees no success, as Chris said. We might not reach a conclusion. We might not reach a suitable solution. But the big, big challenge is to get whoever you're negotiating with on the other side of the table to come round to that way of thinking. Unfortunately, we have quite a large change of personnel often with the people that we are negotiating with. So generally that process has to start each time. But it's you're paid back in spades, really. It is such an integral part. It's so important to do. And you can win many times over. Both parties can.
You need at least one party to be committed to that process. If you've got one party committed, you can bring the other party along if you've got the skills. Mm-hmm. If both parties are willing to do it, it makes it easier. But obviously, if neither party are using that technique, it's not going to happen.
Okay. Can you provide us with some insight into where you start when it comes to an EA negotiation? And some questions, I guess, is, you know, how important is the information from the member surveys? Does APRA accumulate a file of issues that it would like addressed at the next EA through the term of the existing EA? I mean, where do you start?
You start an EA negotiation the day you sign the previous EA. Honestly, there's surveys, but that preparation, in piloting terms, we talk about 5 P's, about preparation, preventing piss poor performance.
Yes.
You wouldn't show up to command training having not opened a book until the day before. The members in APRA are always in touch with the pilots. We have consultative committees. We talk in coffee shops, generally in touch. We have consultative committees, and that's where most of the issues that are happening are raised. And then you get to know what are issues for pilots, what are issues for the company, and you start to formulate ideas on, well, in X years' time when we come to a negotiation, how will those things fit into the negotiation? Taking the feedback from members, the consultative committees and the like would then form the basis of a survey. Mm-hmm. A survey is something that takes sometimes months to write. You've got to hone the questions. You've got to make sure you're asking appropriate and applicable questions. That then gives you an enormous amount of information. You then have to analyse it. And there is a number of ways that that's done. We look at, we'll get a lot of solutions, as Chris said earlier, from that. But when you look at all those, then you can still divide down into the issues. You know, all of these solutions are trying to, they're all solutions to X problem. Okay, so how do we go into an interest space? You go, we have an issue, can we find a solution? That survey is a really important tool for the negotiators. It gives a confirmation check that the information we've been taking on over the years leading up to that point, that we're on the right track, that we are in touch with what the members are looking at, what the company might want through EAs, and putting all that together. It's a lot of preparation work.
Okay. The thing, sorry, before we go on, the thing that I'd like to say about the surveys as well is we often ask questions where you tick a box and say, well, how do you rate these things on a scale of 1 to 10? We get the most value out of the free text comments. And I would really encourage members, when we do put out surveys, to really take the time to put your thoughts in those free text comment boxes. We get some absolute gold and absolute gems in those things. It gives us great ideas. It allows us to categorise also where the real issues lay. We get a good sense of what's important to people, what's less important to people. But one of the biggest things is we get tone. We get to be able to hear what the members are feeling. Are they agitated about certain issues? Are they happy with certain things as well? So that analysis can take days, and it's just all manpower. It's just a matter of sitting down, but you can really categorise it, and you can come up with your three or four different areas of interest for the pilots. And invariably, they could range from pay issues to work-life balance issues to risk versus reward is another category that we often use. And they form the interests that Chris was talking about before. And then we take that to the company, we can come up with our own solutions, but that forms the basis of it. So surveys, critically important to this process.
Yeah, and I think that reinforces the message of, you know, when it comes to members saying, well, what can I do in this process? It's being engaged, and obviously at the point where we get these surveys is take the time to give us as much information as you can, because it forms the backbone of where you guys start.
I think they need to be engaged. They need to be informed. Okay. I know something we see in surveys is, or when we talk to members, they'll say, I want X. And you say, have you looked in the agreement? You already have X. Oh, do we? Become more familiar with your enterprise agreement. Okay. Know what's in it.
Yep.
Be engaged with it so that when you do a survey, you can take an informed view and answer questions and give really good quality feedback. The better feedback we receive, the better outcomes we can achieve.
Okay. Is it becoming more of a challenge to deal with the company regarding the way they now wish to engage in industrial negotiations?
We have varying opinions on this. I mean, it's not easy for starters. Did you want to go first, Chris?
Yeah, I started becoming involved in EA negotiations with long-haul EA9, and that had occurred just after the lockout, after we had the big meeting between pilots and company, and we had the sacred scroll. We had some changes in Qantas management, and we stepped into that negotiation with the company coming to us and saying they wanted to do things differently. And industrial relations side of the business was pretty much pushed to the side, and we dealt mainly with flight operations, and we acted in a really collaborative way. And since then, we've, in my opinion, seen a change back to where we were sort of 12 years ago, where we've now got a very hard line industrial approach to things. So My view is I think that it's becoming a little more industrial relations driven rather than flight operations driven, and that's made the process more difficult for us.
Right. And other opinions?
Well, I mean, I agree largely with that. What I didn't want to do was to have all the listeners think that it's just a lost cause, because it's not. The negotiations that I've been involved with have been largely short haul. And what we spoke about before about, you know, getting the other side to engage in a more interest-based bargaining collaborative approach, that is absolutely possible. It's difficult and it takes a lot of work, but it is still currently impossible. But we have... Often people think of Qantas or their employer as one homogenous group. As Chris just alluded to, generally in the day-to-day running of the work that we're involved in, it's flight operations that we're dealing with. Yep. And there is a very good working relationship with flight operations. APRA and flight operations, and indeed pilots and flight operations, won't always agree. And that is a very healthy thing. But at the end of the day, 99% of the time, a way forward can be found. And so when we hear things from the chief pilot, if we've had a very, very difficult week up the East Coast or from head of base operations, and they say, thank you, we really appreciate what you've done, it's a genuine thing. Flight operations actually believes that. The thing I think that frustrates members a lot is every 4 years come EA time, well, where is all that thanks? And how, when it comes time to actually writing a document and putting the money on the table, where is all that gratitude from before? The big difference is there are other players at the table within Qantas at that point. Yep. And the interests of those parties on the other side of the table, they're not necessarily the same. Flight operations has to live with the day-to-day ramifications of any agreement that is made. There are other departments within Qantas where that's possibly not true. They might have other motivations, their team might have other motivations, and the individuals within that team might have other motivations as well. So... We hear things going back as far as the lockout in the mainline sense. We have pilots being called kamikaze pilots. Other areas of the company, like flight attendants, are being threatened with termination. The pilot groups, every single time a new aircraft is trying to be introduced, we see this tendency to go down the path of, well, if you don't agree to what we're putting forward, we will send the flying elsewhere. So from that side of the company, or from that section of the company, yeah, I would have to agree, it's escalated. It's emboldened that side of the company. But when we're talking about other areas of the company, such as flight operations, the working relationship is still there, and it is possible to make these inroads and get a good outcome, a win-win outcome.
But Hoff, I also think it's important to say that, you know, it's not just Qantas that have been emboldened the past few years. We see it actually across the industry and across Australia, employers taking more and more bold steps under the Fair Work Act and using the full extent of the Act. And possibly many would say, you know, beyond what was the intention of the Act to drive certain outcomes. I mean, that is exactly what has resulted in the Job Summit, and the ACTU is fully aware of, you know, that wages have not kept up with the cost of living the last 10 years. Since the Fair Work Act, which we must point out was enacted by the Labor government, did not deliver what it promised it should. So yes, it is in Qantas, but I also want to just point it out. It's a trend across Australia.
So it feels as if the industrial landscape is such that allows them to do it.
Correct.
And I guess they're trying to maximise or take advantage of that. It just seems whether or not the pendulum will start to swing back the other way, I don't know.
Well, we've been quite upfront in the last, you know, 6 months since the election of the Labor government, that they do now have the mandate to do something about it and push that pendulum back. We've drafted a position paper that people can go and watch check out on our website, and we've said to them, it's now your opportunity to change this and put it back. So we are hopeful, but you know, we're not holding our breaths either.
I think it's probably an appropriate point to maybe touch on in a little bit more detail the good faith bargaining requirements, in that sets goes to form part of the landscape in which we have to deal with, and, you know, what can an employer do come bargaining time. A lot of people apply their own test, I think, or a moral type of test of what does good faith bargaining actually mean. There are a number of requirements under the Act, and it talks about things like attending meetings, giving genuine consideration to any proposals that are made. The latter part of that section actually says the good faith bargaining requirements do not require a bargaining representative to make concessions. It does not require a bargaining representative to reach agreement. So an employer can sit there on the other side of the table, fold their arms and simply say, no, we disagree with all that, we're not agreeing to that. And once an agreement has reached its normal expiry date, the agreement just continues as it was at that point in time. So there's no pay rises. So the system is set up such that a company can meet its good faith bargaining requirements, but simply sit there and wait, you know, in familiar terms, for back pay to build up. Completely legal. And that would tend to indicate that the landscape and the pendulum is probably shifted too far towards the employers.
Good faith in name only to me.
Yeah. Well, it's a very legalistic definition, yeah. Don't try and put your own moral compass on it.
But I think there too, the point being that when the agreement reaches the end of its period there, you're continuing on with no wage rises, but then you've also now got the added threat that Philip mentioned before, where now employers have got favourable decisions where not only are there no pay rises, but they can threaten to terminate the agreement. So then employees then will revert to an award which is significantly lower conditions than what they may have under their agreement.
That's exactly what just happened to the flight attendants.
Yes, that's right. So then, as Philip said before, that's one of the things they're trying to change so that that's not a threat available to employers.
Yeah, that is absolutely one of the things they say that they would address. But as I said, we haven't seen the legislation yet, so we don't know exactly how far they are prepared to go. We hope that, you know, it goes to the point where it can only be terminated if a person is not better off under the award or better under the agreement than the award, or when no employees are covered by it. But it will be interesting to see how far the Labor Party is willing to go.
Those good faith bargaining provisions go both ways. I've often been asked by members that, well, why didn't you ask for this? And we said, well, we did. We went through the process and the company said no, because they can't. But the same thing happens the other direction. I don't think that the company in all entities doesn't come to the table with sometimes egregious claims, things that would be unimaginable to us to agree to, and we say no, we give it all its due consideration and we won't agree. So they do go both ways.
Okay.
This concludes part one of episode 4 of Stick With It, discussing industrial relations and negotiating EAs. Part 2 includes discussions on the issue of professional negotiators and the role you can play in the wider EA process. Thanks for listening.